Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy, knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
How often do you get to go fishing with two of the best of the best of the best? I'm talking about Captain Scott Null, Captain Caleb McCumber. And while you're not going to be on the water with my buddies, we always say it's right there at the top of the banner on our Facebook group page. The next best thing to being on the water is the Bite Me podcast. So we are here for you. I'm John Lopez, and that is Scott and Caleb. And boy, I had a really, really fun show last week. Caleb is back because I sent this. It's just really detailed, as I often do, a very thorough rundown of everything. And I want to give Caleb an actual gold star. Just like you used to get in first grade and second grade from your teacher, because Caleb came in and, like, you know, sucking up to the teacher, said, "Hey, I want you to know, I read the whole rundown.
I read the whole rundown, and we didn't stick to any of it last week.
We really didn't stay that much.
That does not mean we're going to follow it.
That's exactly. But you get a gold star anyway. You guys know what to
do.
We'll try. You guys know what to do. Let's get into it, but remember to subscribe. Thank you. I always thank you because you guys are the reason that this podcast has become so successful and, you know, does so well in all the little rankings and ratings that people put out there. And so many of our friends are part of it, 6,500 on the group page. But you can subscribe, and as soon as this podcast drops, as the kids say, you'll get a notification. And that goes for iTunes and Spotify and Google Podcasts and everything else. As well. So appreciate you guys being a part of this. So let's not waste any more time because we got a lot to cover, long way to go and a short time to get there. Let's start with this. And this is from a listener, as always. Today, the first, well, let me go through everything so you'll know what's coming up. Why do you fish there? Best retrieves and presentations for different baits. Kind of debunking the I can't throw artificials myth. And certainly, I want to get into some big trout hunting because, and maybe even the tarpon at the jetties, because we've gotten a lot of posts and comments on that on the group page. But why do you fish there was one of the questions. And here it is, guys. I have a broad question, and it might be hard to give a short answer, but please bear with
me. Here goes the show.
Here we go. Why do you fish where you do? Is it proximity to home, familiarity with the area, or the place with the best fishing? If you're a guide, and he's noting Caleb here, do you fish a particular area because you're professionally established, or is there some other reason? I grew up taking vacations in Port A. Naturally, I feel comfortable fishing Port A and Redfish Bay, confident in those areas. My gear is set up for fishing those places. Thanks for always the quality broadcast. Scott, you and I have touched on this back in the day. Maybe some people haven't heard that particular podcast. So I'm going to start with Caleb because I know you have some opinions on this, Scott. But, you know, it is a good question. Why do you fish where you fish? I personally grew up like this fella, fishing a lot of Port Aransas. I was a big Copano Bay fan, certainly Mustang Island, all that stuff. I grew up, started fishing a lot in East Matagorda when I was in college and right out of college. Then kids and everything gets in the way, and I go to Sabine and spend about 5 years there. When I get back on the water, Trinity Bay, I spent, you know, several years fishing Trinity Bay and learning Trinity Bay. Now I'm back at East Matagorda and Matagorda and loving life. Me personally, just to kind of to set it up, every time I've dug into a particular location, why I fish there, it's been more curiosity than anything because I could move. Now that I'm getting older and am older, I want to put down some so-called roots, some retirement, seeds, if you will, and just a place that I love. So I think the reasons vary. If you're dragging your boat, and we all started dragging our boats to particular bays, I used to always fish Trinity, East Matagorda, and Sabine, just because I wanted to learn those three. But what are your reasons for where you are?
Man, it's a little bit of everything, really. Mm-hmm. I live, my home is about an hour from Matagorda. I'm professionally established in Matagorda. I have a base camp there, you know, all that kind of whatnot. I'm very familiar with the area. I think 01 is the first year I went to Matagorda, and my college roommate had a house there on the water. So we learned all of it. I would say the thing that keeps me in Matagorda, because after the freeze, I looked very hard at going to West Galveston. And I'm
still looking, thinking about it, but I don't think I'm going to move.
And I'm probably not the most versed guy in West Galveston, but I feel like I could learn it pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. What keeps me in Matagorda, the main draw that keeps me there, is I've got east of the Colorado River is the mud and the shale and the back lakes and the big trout fishing type scenario. West of the Colorado River, I've got clear water, I've got grass, I've got such a diverse ecosystem there that I'm getting the upper coast and the middle coast and even some of the characteristics of the lower coast all mm-hmm. in the same place. So no matter what's happening, I can usually move around and make it work. And so that's why I guide in Matagorda. Just whenever I was thinking about going to West Galveston, I contacted several customers, and every one of them was, hey, wherever you want us to meet, we'll go. I've got people that want to go to Louisiana still. And, you know, you touched on that. I fish Louisiana because I like exploring. Mm-hmm. I like how it is over there. But the reason that I am in Matagorda, it isn't because the fishing is just off the chain phenomenal right now. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm established at, and it's a lot of moving parts to move me somewhere else, I guess would be the honest answer.
Now, you've said you felt you did a lot of exploring, like I was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up fishing Galveston. Mm-hmm. And grew up there off I-45 and always in Galveston. Then my old father-in-law, before Camille and I got married, took me to Port O'Connor mm-hmm. and dropped me and my buddy David off on the South Shore line before daylight and said, I'll be back to pick y'all up later. Okay.
Yeah. He said, what does later mean?
He says, keep a bunch of fish. We got a bunch of family coming. He'd rent a big six-bedroom house, and then it had a bunkhouse in the front. It's a huge house. It's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. It's right where Froggy's is.
Okay.
It was right next door to that. And he'd rent that house for weeks, and then they'd have family come in from Arkansas and all that. Anyway, so I'm out there. We're dropped off in the dark. Well, we grew up wading Galveston, and, you know, I mean, 6 inches of visibility is awesome.
Yeah.
As it got daylight, we're not catching anything. We did the usual thing, waded out waist deep, mm-hmm. then chest deep, you know, we're throwing out. And one of my shoes came untied. We wore Converse.
Yeah, yeah.
Converse high tops was the wading shoes back then. Yeah. So I had to go back shallow to tie my shoe up. Well, I walked back shallow, and there's a bunch of redfish up there swimming around in this grass. And you could look down, and you could see your feet. And I was like, what the hell? And there's clear water in Texas. So that was the beginnings of it. And from that, David and I, in fact, we're just texting a minute ago. He's texting me, asking about dove hunting. He's up in Nebraska now. Mm-hmm. But we started going further and further south, and we ended up going down to Port Mansfield and South Padre.
Now look at this water.
We went all over the place, and, you know, we fell in love with different places. We weren't tied down with kids then. Mm-hmm. And so both of us were, you know, we could take off and go for 3 or 4 or 5 days mm-hmm. without any problem. Well, then once we had kids, we backed it up a little bit, so we started going to Rockport mm-hmm. and Port Aransas. Still got the clear water, still had the, you know, all that. Well, then eventually I just worked my way back, you know, to Port O'Connor and back to Galveston. When I started guiding, I lived in
Galveston.
I lived in Pearland, so I needed to guide Galveston.
So it was more practical than anything.
It was practical.
Yeah.
When we decided to get us a place on the coast, we looked everywhere, man. I mean, mm-hmm. we looked at property on the Arroyo. We looked at some stuff in Port Mansfield. All of that's so far away from Houston. Kids are grown. They've got their families established. They're mm-hmm. they're in the Houston area. Camille didn't want to be that far away from grandbabies.
Right.
And so Port O'Connor was a real good spot for us that was a compromise. Mm-hmm. The thing that I really enjoy about Port O'Connor is kind of like what Caleb was talking about. It's got so many different things that I like to do. It's got the shallow water back, you know, back in the back. I can get back there and pole around and mm-hmm. sight cast for redfish.
Got your jetties.
Which is what I'm known for. And then I started doing the tarpon thing on, mm-hmm. you know, off the beachfront. You got the jetties.
So when the grandkids come down, we can go to the jetties and just drop some shrimp. It's got a lot of variety, and it's all fairly close and fairly easy to get to.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and the other part was property was inexpensive.
Yeah.
I mean, I was able to buy 80 acres down there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I wanted to be out of the city. I wanted to live on a piece of property the way I grew up, you know, hanging out on properties like that. So it just all made sense. Plus, I've got a lot of friends there.
Right.
You know, the magazine I've been writing for, the you know, Texas Saltwater Fishing Magazine all those years. The magazine is literally, I can damn near see it from my deer stand. I can almost see the office. So I've got them. I've got, you know, all these, Stephen Plant. I've mm-hmm. talked about him on here. He's got a house right down the street from me. So it's close enough to Houston where all my Houston friends have weekend places down
right,
there.
Right.
So it's... it's fun.
It's fun. You know,
because we got a lot of people that hang out down there on the weekends and on during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And another buddy of mine just bought 50 acres across from me. So it's convenient enough to Houston to where people can come down for a weekend and come visit, but it's far enough that they don't stay.
And so in terms of, yeah, in terms of advice for someone, it's kind of like all three of us have similar stories. It goes with convenience first for your lifestyle. But also what your plan is for the next, my plans have changed, you know, three or four times in terms of, you know, where I'm fishing because it was more convenient for me to, you know, where I lived in Humble or Kingwood. And then now I can go down more. I can do more longer weekends. I can go from work, the kids are all grown up, and go spend 2 days and come into work from Sergeant.
Right.
I mean, I've done that a lot. I fished, especially in the summertime.
Well, you worked from there.
I worked from there. I did the show from there during the pandemic. So... yeah, that's the best why, but also just, you know, we always go back, you know, to learn it.
Well, know what kind of fishing you want
right,
to do.
Learn what you want
and
to do.
And then pick a place that's convenient that has that kind of fishing.
Right.
Yeah, I like clear water. I like offshore. If I just like clear water, I could do, you know, the Matagorda thing
mm-hmm.
and have be able to run over to West Bay and do what Caleb's
then
talking
do the
about.
Mud
and,
East
I like
Bay.
The, and I like the marsh stuff too, which would be fine, but yeah. I like offshore. I like being on the beachfront. I've got super easy access
mm-hmm.
to run straight out. Probably Port O'Connor next to Port Aransas. Port Aransas is the easiest to get
yeah.
offshore.
Yeah.
But we're probably the second easiest place along
oh,
the coast.
Oh, for sure. And easy out. And easy in virtually any, you know, regular boat. You know, with the jetties yeah. helping you out. Like we got to go through Mitchell's
Port Isabel.
Cut. Port Isabel, yeah.
Port Isabel's the probably the prime.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so this is one of those topics that I know you both have said this in the past, but we could do a whole show
oh, here
on
he
that.
Goes, trying to keep us on topic.
I got some nerve. You know, we could do a whole show on that. You know, you guys have said repeatedly. Got the question about retrieves and presentations for different baits. I'll read the question so people know. Happy found your podcast. Dad got a fishing camp down in Sargent in the 80s. After growing up, took a 20-year break or so. For the past couple of years, buddies and I have been going around finding new places to fish. One of the biggest changes from the way I fished with my dad is using plastics. My dad did not do much fishing. He pretty much stuck to catching Louisiana style with live shrimp. I grew up thinking that a speckled beetle was the only way to fish with artificials. Love for you guys to do a really in-depth on retrieves and presentation. Shallow water, dirty water, different baits, etc. But where do we begin on that? I mean, retrieves and presentation... I mean, I'll just kick it to you first, Caleb, just because, you know, you fish so many baits. I know you have a great, you know, sort of words of advice on how to fish corkies. But let's start with what is plastics are there. What makes you, I mean, it changes. It's like from, not just from trip to trip, but from like spot to spot or even in the same spot, you can change your retrieve, right?
How much time we got?
I know. We could do a whole show. And hey, with no time constraints on these topics, we can always kick some of these other topics to next week. So well, let's dig in.
I would hate to start doing that.
No, we never do that.
Yeah, we're going to kick tarpon into December.
No, yeah. Remember when they were catching tarpon back in September? No, go ahead.
All right, so let's generalize, I guess. We're going to be here for hours.
It's okay.
Dirty, off-colored water. I want to move a lot of water. Mm-hmm. I'm going to probably, my first go-to will be a paddle tail. I'll have a straight retrieve with some twitches in there. So I don't get real crazy with the paddle tail. I want it to be somewhat natural, but I want it to move enough water to get attention of something.
Mm-hmm.
You could go on to a spinner bait. That moves a lot of water. The rat tails, you can use them in dirty water. I prefer them more in a green water or a cleaner water.
Mm-hmm.
A rat tail, man, when I first started fishing, I had this retrieve where I basically just drug my rod tip from, 3 o'clock to noon,
mm-hmm,
in a pretty quick fashion, and then reeled back down. And as I was reeling down, the lure would fall. Since then, I've gotten fancier where I have, you know, twitch this and twitch, right, twitch that. But every once in a while, when I'm not catching fish, I'll go back to that really super easy, super simple retrieve and start catching fish on that. But what the way I try to look at it is, if I'm throwing a rat tail, I want it to either be popping around like a shrimp, or I want it to be hopping around like, maybe an eel or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'm throwing a paddle tail, I want it to, you know, mimic a bait fish.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The up and down bait fish going back.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, he kind of comes up, he kind of comes down. But, you know, that's pretty well the nuts and bolts of how I look at plastics and how I use them. Now, don't get me wrong, I will absolutely throw a paddle tail in clean or green water. But in dirty water, I'm not nearly as likely to throw that rat tail, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Before we move on to other baits, your thoughts on that? The plastic, good old-fashioned soft plastic, a lot of people, that's your introduction to artificials.
You'll see probably 90% or better of mine's paddle tail.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason is, when you're guiding, it's simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's really easy. The bait has a lot of motion to it, even if you just do a straight retrieve. And a lot of times what I've seen on redfish in really, really shallow water is a straight retrieve vary the speed,
mm-hmm,
but not the jigging.
Mm-hmm.
If you start jigging up and down a whole lot with redfish in shallow water, they seem to turn off of it. Mm-hmm. It kind of spooks them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see fish do that. You don't see bait fish do that. You see them scurry on top. You know, they'll speed up, scurry on top, and then kind of dive to the bottom sometimes. But for the most part, they're just cruising. You know, they're maintaining a speed.
Right.
You have to learn how to feed a fish. You know, and there's various ways of doing it. When you can see them, you get a real quick education on that.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, bringing it in there really quick to one can turn them off. It can spook the hell out of them.
Yeah.
I go back to the old thing that my biologist buddy tells me, nothing in the bays commits suicide.
That's right.
So if something's swimming towards a redfish, I don't care how little it is, we throw flies at them. And if you bring a fly directly at one, like coming from the front at, mm-hmm, an angle, they'll spin off of it.
But it's not natural.
Spook.
It's not normal.
Yeah, it's not natural and normal. So think about what you see bait fish doing and what you see shrimp doing and try to mimic that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, when you're out and you're blind casting, you know, you say you're wading a shoreline, just blind casting out there, try to remember what the hell you were doing when you did catch one.
That's exactly what
it's
I was
going to say. It's so hard.
Yeah.
You know, especially on a slow morning,
mm-hmm,
and you're trying all different kind of things. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're reeling in one time, you're doing your twitch and you're doing your thing. And then you feel your phone buzz and you kind of reach up for a second and glance at it. Next thing you know, boom, you got a hit. Well, hell.
What did I do?
What did I do? Oh, I was twitch, and then I just let it fall to the bottom. Kind of like what Caleb was talking about. Then I started to pick it back up, and the fish was there.
Mm-hmm.
So the retrieves vary from day to day, sometimes hour to hour.
I know, Caleb, you want to add something here, but just to add on to what Scott said, that I changed mine. How many of us have been there, like, there's bait? You've maybe even seen some flashes out of the corner of your eye. You know there's some fish there. There's something there. It's one of those days where you're like, I know there are fish here. When I'm in that spot, that's when I will change my retrieve 10 times. Because, you know, it's one thing to change your retrieve and there's nothing there. There's nothing really biting it, whatever. Lockjaw, no fish, no bait, whatever. But if I know there's fish there, I know there it's something. I don't just change bait. And then I've told my kids this, you know, don't just change the color a lot. Don't just change. I'm like Scott. I use paddle tail, maybe not 90, but a good 80% of the time. I use paddle tail. Don't just change the profile. Change the retrieve sometimes, because if you know that, and sometimes when you say you know there's fish there, you still don't catch because they're just not biting. But when I know there's fish, that's when I'll change the speed of retrieve, the depth of the retrieve, maybe even the jig head weight, etc. But other than that, I think you can catch fish if they're going to be biting.
That pretty well sums it up. But yeah, no, I'll use a bunch of different retrieves before I start changing lures on them.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times when you're standing there with your buddies fishing, everybody's got a different something on anyway. So that, mm-hmm. that kind of takes out the idea of changing lures out of the equation altogether.
Right. So it's got to be something else.
Right. You know, Scott said, remember what you're doing. One of the number one things that I usually point out to a customer that they didn't seem to pick up on is we're fishing and they'll get bit right under the boat and they'll be like, oh, that fish is right under the boat. And I don't necessarily always believe that. I think that fish was kind of cold trailing that lure.
You see them sometimes.
Yeah. And I think that usually before you reel in, there's two different types of people. There's the guy that's going to kind of just drop it and let it sit there for a second and then reel it in. And there's the guy that's working it and he's going to go straight to bringing it in quick.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're getting bit right by the boat and you're the guy that's bringing it in quick, well, then make quick movements way out there. If you're the guy that drops it and then brings it in, well, drop it and let it go lower and slower out there.
Right.
You know, and then what Scott was saying about the fish in the marsh, that's the number one thing I say on my boat when we're fishing is quit hopping that lure. That's a bait thing. That's a trout thing. The hopping will mm-hmm. definitely turn them off of it. I see it a lot whenever I'm sight casting. I don't know if I finesse it or what. I am pretty good on hookups when I bring a lure to a fish.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I do it is it's a very nonchalant, like maybe that bait didn't see that fish there or something.
He's because, just whistling Dixie.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, there's, cause I'll get into this, you'll get, I call it a speed jam. It's an old rodeo term. Mm-hmm. Speed jam is what we call it. And we're tournament fishing and I see the fish that I want and I am scared that he's about to spook off the boat or something. And I'll throw in front of him and I'll bring it to him real fast. That typically doesn't they hate that. But because you get in situations sight casting where that fish is pointing away from you,
mm-hmm.
and you got two choices. You can make him eat it or you can hit him in the butt with the boat. And that's the one thing I have is I'll bring it real slow and nonchalant, or I'll bring it about, I don't know, 10-8 inches from him and drop it and let it sit on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some other little tricks in there on how I drop it and let it sit on the bottom. We'll talk about that after the Redfish World Series. but no, Scott is 100%.
That's a tease.
Yeah, Scott is 100% correct in the hoppy. If when you're in the bay and you're jigging it up and down, you're covering a lot of water columns. When you're in the marsh in 2 feet of water, you don't need to cover that many columns. In fact, the only rule
there's only one water column, pretty much.
The only rule I have that's almost always consistent is I want that lure at eye level or below eye level on a redfish. Mm-hmm. I don't ever want it above him. I want it at his level or a little below him. So if you're hopping it up and down, then you're kind of, it's just not really the fruit.
Unless you're throwing a topwater.
The juice isn't worth the squeeze. Is that how it goes?
Isn't worth the squeeze, isn't it?
I don't know.
Something like that.
I said fruit, then I went juice. I'm not real sure. Hey, don't hop your lure in the marsh.
Or squeeze your juice.
Don't squeeze your juice. So Scott, you know, I want to get into, again, we can, you know, just completely dig into this because it's good. I want to get into corkies because we're getting into near corky time here, although you can throw them all year round. But part of the second part of this question that I threw to you guys was somebody was asking about belly weighted jigs. You know, you mentioned them last week, and then I got the question. It was on my bat phone, my regular phone. What did he mean by that? Because and when do you throw them? You know, the belly weighted,
pretty much all the time
in the marsh.
Yeah, anytime I'm in the grass in the marsh, it's a weedless. They're basically their swim bait mm-hmm. is where they came from, is the bass world.
Mm-hmm. But you mentioned it in a recent podcast, and we didn't really describe it then, so I want to do it now. And
usually
it fits with this topic.
Yeah, attached to the eye is usually a little spring, and you screw the head of the lure onto that little spring, and then you can run the hook up into it and
You can bury the hook if you're in thick grass. Mm-hmm. Generally, I'll run it all the way through the lure and then
just maybe, a little bit.
Maybe tick the very tip end of the hook mm-hmm. into the back end of the plastic.
Yeah.
It does several things. It makes it swim level and flat for that perfect retrieve of that slow,
kind
easy
of what
retrieve
Caleb was talking
that we're
about.
Talking about.
Yeah.
With a jig head, it's all weighted in the front. So it tends to go down a whole lot faster. You know, there's not as much horizontal movement to it. It's more. A jig head's going to make it dive.
It swims.
I mean, it's going to make it dive down.
Yeah.
This will swim. The other part was when I really started using them a lot was around oyster reefs. You can actually swim that thing through an oyster reef and not hang up.
Mm-hmm.
And that came in real handy when I started guiding, throwing on
for obvious
oyster
reasons,
reefs.
Yeah, a lot
and
of
we're
people,
not losing a lot of lures now. Yeah. You know, that whereas a jig head dives down and it will find a crack in that oyster reef every single
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah, every time.
So, good so, Lord.
Yeah. It looks could kill a guy.
Oh, my gosh. I've hauled in so much oyster.
So you won't. I don't have hardly any regular jig heads, mm-hmm. even on my boat. You know, it's just almost everything.
And to fit in with this, retrieves and presentation is pretty much just a swim, right?
Yeah, it's just a straight swim. Mm-hmm. And you can swim it through the grass. You can swim it through. Hell, I throw it up into the cord grass. You know, when the reds are up there eating shrimp out of the cord grass. You can throw that thing
now,
into
every once
the grass.
In a while, I'll dart mine, but not a lot. Like just kind of a quick little dart here and there as yeah. I'm retrieving.
Yeah, I mean, you see bait fish do that.
Yeah.
You know, so nothing wrong with that. And it, I mean, it's virtually weedless mm-hmm. when you do it this way. And in fact, I had my mom out on the boat. She was a shrimp thrower, mm-hmm. period. You know, and I got her on my Poland skiff when I first got one and said, you know, we're going to throw lures today. She says, where's the shrimp? We don't have shrimp.
No shrimp.
There ain't no shrimp on the boat. I don't even have a live well on this boat. It was kind of a lie. But anyway, I got her throwing that, and she was having a blast doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept saying, just throw it closer to the bank. And that's the other part. You can throw that thing, and if you do hit the grass, everything's fine. Well, mm-hmm. we were in the Lighthouse Lakes where all the mangroves are. And she
hitting mangroves?
She chunked it way the hell back in the mangroves and hung that thing up.
Yeah, that might be an issue.
She said, I thought you said it was weedless. I said, I did. I didn't say it was bushless.
It's not treeless.
Good Lord. Yeah, you can't throw that thing 30 yards into the trees.
You hit the trunk of a tree.
Like Dean used to say, were you fishing for monkeys?
Yeah, that's right.
That was always our deal when we were fishing in Florida.
But you got to throw it up there. That's the story is you got to throw it up there.
I don't know how many pictures I've got of Dean and Dean's got of me standing up in a kayak pulling lures out of trees.
But it's a good bait, and I use it. I use it with the clear deadly that I've talked about on here that has a little red specks, more of a shrimpy thing. So I just kind of reel. It's a good way to learn. Good way for someone to learn with an artificial, right?
Yeah.
Right. It's easy.
I use them with customers that are not landing their cast. I don't have the grass everywhere like Scott does.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I always try to go with the flow here.
You got shorelines though that you can run it through.
No, they can be good. We'll leave. Those things.
I use it occasionally.
I have them on the boat. Mm-hmm. My only problem with them is, yes, the bait swims a lot better with them. But earlier I was talking about I like that lure to be down in front of that fish's face.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have grass in Louisiana. I mean, in a Matagorda to worry about. No. When I'm in Louisiana, a lot of the stuff I fish, I have about a 4-foot hole in the grass that I'll see a redfish stick its head out of or he's swimming across. And I've got to get it to him quick now, right now. And
it's a little easier to
the jig head will zip down in front of him where that belly weight, it does make it float level and everything, but yeah. I fight with it.
It is true. So you can dart it a little quicker. You know, you can shoot the jig head a little quicker, easier.
But if I were fishing in Port O'Connor or anywhere with grass, yes, I would not be fighting a jig head all day. No doubt.
Yeah. All right. So presentations, we're not going to do every single bait, but I think he was talking about plastics and corkies. And you've kind of changed the way I throw corkies, to be honest, because I've seen you do just about everything with that thing on videos and otherwise. But is there like a go-to starting point? And it's a wade fishing thing, by and large. I shouldn't say never, every once in a while I'll stop the boat and there's no real wind and I'll use a corky, but I never really throw it off the boat. It's a wade fishing shoreline type thing. And I've always been of the opinion of let it sink and work it like a topwater underwater. It's a topwater underwater. That's the go-to. You've heard it before. But you don't necessarily subscribe to that. How would you? What would you say are some of the kind of go-tos for working a corky?
No, I mean, that's pretty well exactly. I mean, you hit the nail on the head right there. I use it wading almost all the time. I've bend the nose down quite a bit. I bend the tail down, I don't know, 45 degrees, 40 degrees, something mm-hmm. like that. And that just lets the lure dig some. But I throw it out. I let it sink however long I want it to sink. And then I work it just like a Spook Junior. I walk it back. But instead of being consistent like you would with the top water, I'll stop it and pause mm-hmm. it here and there and whatnot. But that's pretty well, you know, sometimes you walk it fast, sometimes you walk it slow. But, I mean, that's how you get that lure to dart and dive back and forth and entice a bite.
But I've also seen you like really working it fast. I've seen a lot of guys really working it slow,
well, yes.
letting it sit on the bottom before you even start working
that,
it. What would make you do that?
Yeah, that
just
that,
changing it up?
That I don't prescribe to in, is the old adage of if you're working it slow, work it. If you think you're working it slow, work it slower.
Yeah.
By any means. I'll work those things real aggressively, and I'll work them aggressively in cold water. I'm looking at the bait is what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
If it's cold and it's the dead of winter and the bait's hardly moving around or whatnot, that's when I'll put it on bottom or I'll work it real slow. But if there's bait hopping around, I mean, if I'm seeing a piece of bait every 30 seconds or something and it's moving pretty quick, I'll work that lure pretty quick.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to work it slow, just keep it on the bottom. The legends that Pat and I fished in 2017, we were setting them on bottom. We weren't even working them. We were just setting them on bottom and dragging them in real slow.
I think I remember
slow.
You talking about that.
And the fish would just rip it out of your hand. But at the end of the day, you know, no, I'm pretty aggressive with them. But it's paying attention to your environment. You're trying to match how the other fish are acting. If they're stunned, it needs to look stunned. But if they're zipping around, then there you really cannot fish a corky too fast as long as you're not making it spin. And if you bend it correctly, it's not going to spin on you.
And as long as it's working the right way, because they can when you start bending the nose. And I do the nose a lot. I've done the tail some as well. Sometimes it's crooked and it starts just looking all askew.
And it's not
makes a difference.
And it's not always glaringly apparent that it's crooked.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. Now I've seen this on the Bite Me page a lot. I reel it in and it spins while I'm reeling it in. That is not uncommon whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when they're bent just right, they don't spin when you reel them in. But that's not really affecting how it's working out there. But
because it's a different pace.
Yeah, it's a different pace. You're not zipping that sucker in.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if it's bent correctly and you're walking the dog with it, just add some pauses in there, play with it. A corky, you can't. There's really not a wrong way to work a corky. There's you know, what I'm giving you here is the foundation, and then you can go anywhere you want from that. It's a very creative lure.
And before I get Scott's thoughts on this, there's also the perception that it's a winter lure, which is couldn't be further from the truth.
The only way that is true is that if you throw it in the hot months, you're going to get ribbon fish and whatnot tearing it up, but you're still going to catch fish on it. I mean, it's essentially a 3.5-inch mullet shape.
Mm-hmm.
There are 3.5-inch mullet in the bay year round. There's no reason to, you know, you go back to match the hatch. That you're matching the hatch year round with that thing. I know people that don't even own plastics. They just throw corky. The guy that taught me how to throw corkies, I bet I've seen him fish a plastic 3 times in my life.
And that's
12 months a year, you're throwing that corky. You work it faster some months. You work it slower some months.
Yeah.
But 12 months a year, they'll heat it.
Your thoughts, because then I want to get into Camille's expertise with the spoon, because that's the last one I'm hitting. We got others that we're going to hit in future episodes, but presentations and pace, et cetera. But any thoughts on the corky before we get to that?
Fish eat fish.
Fish eat fish.
He covered it real well, but I mean, that whole wintertime thing, that's, yeah, when corkies first came around, that was the secret.
Yeah.
You got to throw it in the winter.
You can only throw plastics in the summer. Did you know that?
Yeah, you throw plastics in the summer, and then you throw that corky as soon as that, you know, first really good cold front came in, then you started throwing the corky.
Yeah.
And honestly, I do think a whole lot of that was corkies ain't cheap.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be tearing them up on schoolie trout in the middle of the summer.
Or ribbon fish or ladyfish.
Ribbon fish, gaff top will murder a corky. Oh. A little black drum.
I'm not familiar with that either.
Yeah.
You're hitting all my hits. Gaff top and oyster shell.
A redfish.
I'm the king.
A redfish will wad a corky up.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
They'll make it into a little plastic ball.
Mm-hmm.
All right, before we move on to the next topic that doesn't have to do with presentation and approach there, Scott, you know a lot about spoons, and the reason I brought this one up in this discussion is because I think it's another kind of entry level, and people look at them and they say, how does that catch fish? Do I just throw it and reel it? Or is there any secrets to setting it up, et cetera? The quick one rundown, because I know you and Camille especially has thrown a lot of them.
That's pretty much all Camille will throw.
Yeah.
I mean, if she got on my boat and there wasn't a spoon in there, I'd be in trouble.
Yeah.
She works them just like a soft plastic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we're fishing deeper water,
and everything,
she'll let it, she'll bounce it a little more in the deeper water.
Mm-hmm.
If we're fishing shallow, sight casting a red, she's going to just give it a nice, easy retrieve.
Mm-hmm.
That's another lure you don't want spinning. You think of a spoon, you think, oh, it's spinning. You want it to wobble.
Mm-hmm.
So
sideways, like.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it wobbles straight up and down. You know, the scoop side.
In one direction.
Yeah, the scoop side is down.
Yeah.
And so you can kind of, one thing that works really well, and go smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I see everybody want to throw these bigger spoons. The 1/8 ounce gold spoon mm-hmm. is a killer for redfish. But you can wobble that thing, and you can surf it on top. Like, you throw way too far past a fish, reel it quick, get it up on top. You don't make any disturbance at all. It just slides across the top, get it closer to that fish, and then just let it drop.
Yeah.
And I'll tell that to my customers.
Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
A lot. Okay, you got it there. It's above them, like Caleb was talking about. You don't want it above the redfish. You want it down.
Mm-hmm.
And that little wobble as it's just free falling works damn near every time.
Mm-hmm.
They'll hammer it.
And it's versatile and another kind of entry level one for so many people.
And it's weedless. It's weedless, and it doesn't get hung up in the shell either.
All right. So this was an interesting one to me, and I don't know if I have an answer to this, so I'm going to give it to you two guys, because I have my preferences, but I think it's more just my personal preference as a fisherman. The question is about a lot of times, everybody talks about this time of year. We're getting into mid-September, so it's going to start cooling off. But, you got to get up early in the heat. The water is laying down a lot better, generally speaking, in the mornings. So people say fish early in the morning or late in the afternoon, evening, into the night. So the question is, what's different about that? Should I fish any differently in the evening if I woke up late? Or miss the morning bite than I would in the mornings. Do you have any thoughts on that? Because I'll just give you mine as we're setting it up here. I just like the feel of fishing in the evenings. It's something about it. And the day's closing down. I generally have fished for a while.
Nobody's out there.
It's nice and quiet. To me, it's my peace. You know, I don't, and I tend to fish maybe a little. One spot a little calmer, more deliberately, because I know, well, this is my last spot. I'll be here a couple hours, be here an hour, and then I'll head in. So I don't know if that's necessarily a strategy as much as just my personal bliss.
I like fishing in the evening because I don't like to get up early in the morning.
Well, that too. I mean, I think that's what the question, because he didn't word it like that. He was like, a lot of times I miss the morning bite. So
when you get back, it's time for a cold one, all the good stuff.
Yeah. But is there...
I fish it opposite of the morning, okay? Whenever I get out early in the morning, as the sun's coming up, I'm throwing a topwater for a good amount of time, and then I'm switching to a plastic. In the evening time, I'm starting with a plastic, and then as the sun starts to get low and starts to set, then I'm probably going to switch to a topwater. It just, a fish will eat a topwater all day long, but they seem to respond best whenever you're getting in the low light,
mm-hmm.
and I think the silhouette looks a little bit better to them. I think they're starting to get a little bit more aggressive, especially this time of year when the water's so hot that it's starting to cool off and feel better for them. I do think the things I don't love about the evening is you're going to fish areas that you don't know how much has been ran over and beat up that day.
That's exactly what I know you were thinking that too, Scott.
And then the water is going to be cooling off after dark, where in the morning that water is cooler, you know, right there when that sun's coming up. I think that the morning bite typically is probably going to be your more consistent one. But at the end of the day, I just swap it around. I just fish the way I'd fish in the morning, but I do it backwards.
I just very rarely ever fish in the evenings.
Which I love it. I mean, fishing in the evenings.
I would, and I used to before I was guiding. But guiding, you're most of the time you're hitting
it
at daylight. You know, you're hitting it before daylight, and so you've already fished, you know, until 2 o'clock, 1 o'clock, three o'clock.
Yeah.
And you're pretty tired from that. If I go out to fish on my own and go out in the evening, which I've done a few times, and then I got to get up and do it again in the morning. That's kind of hard on a body.
See, that's where fishermen like me that fish a lot but don't do it professionally, I can go in and lay in the trailer for an hour or two,
right?
Have lunch, and then go back out.
Yeah, if it was just me fishing for myself, and I used to do it, we'd make those trips to Mansfield or wherever, we would fish for 3 or 4 hours in the morning and then come back in during the heat of the day, lay up, take a nap, you know, hang out, get a little bit to eat, and then go back out and hit it for the last 2 or 3 hours of the day.
I truly love it. It's just somebody coming in on the dock, on the ramp, when it's getting dark or it's dark, you know.
See, I've got to have my boat cleaned up and ready to go for the next day and all that stuff. And if I was, when I was a young guy first starting out in this business, I wasn't that young, but I was starting off, you know, after I'd retired.
Yeah.
I got this bright idea because Camille was going to be out of town for a week. And I said, you know, she's going to be out of town for 9 days. I'll offer up a special.
Oh, no.
And I'll call it Too Hot to Fish. And we'll run out in the morning and we'll fish no later than 10 o'clock. And then I'll do an evening trip.
Yeah.
And I'll, you know, I'll do two trips.
Double up.
I'll do two trips a day.
Caleb's shaking his head.
I booked every day, all 9 days, morning and evening.
Oh, you got no sleep.
I was dead.
You got no sleep.
Because it's summertime.
Yeah.
It's not getting dark till 9.
Yeah.
It's getting daylight pretty damn early. So I ended up doing a whole lot. I slept in my truck. I lived 45 minutes from the ramp.
Oh.
So I slept in my truck a whole lot during that time, just running my truck and sleeping in the air conditioner in the truck during the middle of the day. That was the biggest mistake I ever made.
I'll do evening trips, but whenever I do it, it's every day is going to be an evening trip.
A morning trip is
not an option, but there's always that transition time. And whenever I start doing them is whenever, you know, myself or Pat, Pat has a tendency to stay out until 3:30. I'm a little bit older and a little bit slower than Pat. I can't handle that.
Yeah.
But whenever we start noticing that towards the end of our morning trip is when we're starting to get bit the most, then we'll transition into evening trips and we'll go out about 3:30 and we'll fish in the dark. It's nice because you know you're going out there with some wide open water.
Right.
It as you're going out to work and watching all your buddies coming in from work, that stings a little bit. But like Scott was saying, that entire week that I'm doing evening trips, my boat doesn't get washed. I usually it gets gas put in it a lot less often. You know, stuff like that. It'll kick your butt. But I will absolutely guide in the evenings.
One other thing, and this kind of is counterintuitive, but because we always say you can throw a topwater any time of day. But I will say, just speaking selfishly, as a guy that likes to fish in the evenings, it's so much cooler when you get hit by a topwater as the sun's going down. And that's the television mode. You know, that's when you go into TV mode, like, well, this would look great on TV. And it's just nice and calm, and you're working your topwater. Wow, hits it. So I think for like guys like me, strategically, I do like what you say, and I think I've done that without even realizing what I was doing. You kind of work it backwards, you know, plastics as it's getting darker, and then maybe topwaters or corkies as it is darker or whatever. But I do like it. I think it's something that you got to be careful with. And this is something that I do all the time, Scott. Just real quick before we move on, the whole time I'm fishing during a day, let's say I get on the water at 11 and I'm going to fish into dark, you know, I miss the morning bite. The whole time I'm fishing, I'm generally and you know, looking, okay, where are people fishing? That I don't want to go there because there's too many boats, and you talked about that a couple of weeks ago. You know, this is one of my favorite spots, but there's a couple of waders there or whatever. So in the evening, when I'm coming back, you know, you've already logged all that stuff. And he said, you know, there was a couple of waders there, but I never saw that many boats. I think I'm going to go there first, you know, because it's not going to be as run over. You know, that's generally how you, you know, kind of keep logging your own mind, you know, what you saw during the day. So when the afternoon hits, it's not someplace that's been trampled.
Well, also, those guys look like they know what they're doing.
That too.
And they stayed there for about 3 hours.
Yeah.
And then they packed up.
It's a good
and,
point.
Then they packed up and left late morning.
With their fish or whatever, or they're catching
or without. Or without.
Yeah, but there's probably a good chance. That
3 hours is a good.
If they stayed, if you saw them there and they didn't move around a whole lot.
Yeah.
And
they're gone now.
And they looked like they knew what they were doing. Chances are good there was some fish there.
Yeah.
And maybe. But the other part of it is we keep talking about, you know, the water cooling off or the water, you know, as, you know, in the morning being cool. And we totally skipped winter. Mm-hmm. Winter is the best time to be out there in the evenings.
Yeah.
Because you've got the sun warming the water all day long, cools off too much overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get that gradual warming. So the warmest time of the day is right before.
Yeah, right before sunset.
Yeah, you got warm water, low light. That can really pay off.
That's good.
Factual information there. Scott, you're teaching our people bad stuff.
Is it? Is it bad or is it selfish? Is Caleb being selfish again?
I mean, it's intelligent. It's intelligent. How about that?
See, Caleb is all in with our philosophy on this podcast. Like, hey, we're no secrets. We're going to tell you everything we like, everything we know. Hopefully you catch a lot of fish. He's all in until it like hits really close to home.
Until I mention this place where bovines are.
He's like, are you sure you want to say that?
Where bovines are captured.
Caleb, you're either in or you're not.
So let me tell you. Okay, story time. Point three. Pat and I were pre-fishing a big tournament, and we noticed this boat was kind of cold trailing us. And it was the
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Third stop of the Legends, and we had done pretty good at the first two.
Just sort of keeping an eye on you?
Yeah, they were staying close to us, and Pat and I noticed. And the funny part is we weren't even pre-fishing. We had already found our fish. All we were doing, we were staying in the general vicinity to see if anybody else, if we had a boat race to deal with or not.
Oh, okay.
But we were just kind of messing around. We'd go one spot and mess around, and then this boat, when we leave, this boat would pull up, and they'd kind of just, you know, jump out and go walk in some circles. And I noticed this after the second time, and Pat and I came up with a plan. So we jumped out in this spot that was absolutely devoid of anything, nothing. And we walked out and we jacked around about 15 minutes. And then Pat stood on his lure and fought his foot for about 5 or 10 minutes. And then turned his back to these guys. And all of them are just
and like reached down.
They're perked up watching. Oh, yeah, dude. And I'm talking like he is splashing water around him. I mean, and then he turns his back to him and he holds his arms out like he's holding a fish. I pull out my phone and I start taking pictures of
him. Empty hands.
Yes. And then I give him a great big high five. We went, woo! And we jumped in our boat and drove off.
Yeah.
And we're watching them and here they come, bud. And, you know, it can backfire just a little bit. But
for our podcast, Bite Me Podcast listeners, you can't be going, hey, shh, shh, shh. You can't be doing that.
I'm just saying you might get a fun. You might get let that boat get plumb out of sight before you go there. But, you know, one thing I did want to hit, because I did mention about them being ran over all day, and you said it. Don't be scared to go there. I've been in some spots in South Texas to where it was odd because we would get there in the morning and there'd be boat after boat after boat after boat stacked up. Well, this particular area was a long ways from any boat ramps, so everybody would usually leave at like 1 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
man, at 2 o'clock, there'd only be one or two boats left, and we would go to where those boats were at. And two of my 30-inch fish came off of those spots. Not an hour after those boats
you're
left.
Preaching to the choir, man. I'm a big fan of I call it regrouping. I don't know if that's what it is or what.
Or they're sliding up. They're doing something.
Yeah, but I have done that. I think I talked about it recently also, Scott, where I was like, catch fish, move on, and don't be afraid to go back there in a couple hours or an hour or whatever. I'm a big fan of that myself.
Yeah, I saw it there multiple times, and it's almost like whenever they heard everything get quiet, they're like, all right, let's go. And they'll slide up on that flat.
We can go
start
outside
eating.
Now.
Yeah.
I do the exact same thing deer hunting. You can, you know, like on our deer leash, you can hear everybody fire up their Can-Am or their Polaris or whatever they're driving at 6 o'clock, 8:30. It's time to go back to camp and go eat breakfast. And I'll stay out till 10.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't believe how many deer I see after all those vehicles
are gone,
take off, and they all run back to camp, and then things quiet down for about 30 minutes. And the deer come walking out. They're like looking around like, okay.
I guess it stopped raining.
It's all cool.
Yeah, we can go outside now.
It's all good. You know? There's times I'll bring snacks and stuff, just sit in the stand all day.
There's a place in, speaking of telling secrets, Sabine, that I used to fish all the time. Pretty popular place, kind of on the north side near Stutes Island. Everybody who fishes Sabine knows where I'm talking about. And right on the cut there of the intercoastal, and you see boat and boat and boat and boat and boat, and everybody's taking long drifts and catching fish. I can't tell you how many times I've just like, all right, I'm out of here. And I go to the other side of the Sabine, and exactly what, after all the boats are gone, I come back down there and wham, 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 wham. They haven't been run off. They haven't been scared. It's crazy. All right, guys, let's talk about this, because I teased it last week, so we got to get to it now. Got to get to it now.
He's going
to
have us working overtime.
I am going to have you working overtime. Next minute, we're doing all right. We're doing all right. Keep it right about an hour or so. Big trout hunting. We've seen a lot of nice trout on the Bite Me group page. And it's encouraging. I hope, and it seems like most of them, Scott, are catching and releasing. This is one of the more encouraging things, Caleb, that I've seen. And you are out on the water. You have all your friends and people that we just talked about and continue to talk about on this podcast. Big trout. We're getting into late summer. We're in September. We're looking at October, November. Do you think it's going to be that much different this year? Because we are seeing some bigger trout. Now, we're seeing fewer trout. Speaking from personal experiences, I'm not catching as many as I usually do this time of year. But are we still going to have some big trout? We saw so many big ones dead after the freeze. But do you still think it's going to be happening?
I still think there's some. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to. I mean, obviously, there's no way there's as many as there was.
Right.
We saw too many of them gone. But I still think there's some out there. I still think there's going to be some fish being caught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was.
How are you going to approach it?
I was talking to somebody about this earlier this morning, and one thing that I look to happen, I think that they're going to be more grouped up, and I think they're going to be further off the shoreline. I think they're going to be in deeper water, and it's going to be one of those situations when you catch one, you have an opportunity to catch three or four, or maybe more.
Why is that? What's your thinking on that?
It just, over the past several years, that's the pattern I've begun to see. Mm-hmm. There were years and years there where you'd find them in singles and doubles and trios. And the past several years, they're starting to be in groups more and more. And what we've seen this summer after that freeze is the fish are still, they're grouped up a lot more and more. It's hard to go somewhere and just catch one or two fish. You're either going to really struggle or you're going to catch a lot of fish.
The Scott Null hero zero.
Yeah. And that's proven to be very true. But I look for that to continue with the bigger fish. In fact, the bigger fish may be continued to be caught out of boats this winter. Last winter was really good out of boats. Wading was kind of hit and miss, but the boat guys were bringing them in more and more and more. And I think that has more to do with the spawn and how they're spawning than anything else. But that's my prediction. But at the end of the day, I'm very curious to see what kind of activity
we
see this fall.
Especially from your circle of friends, our circle of friends, you know, how are they doing it and where it's coming from. It's interesting. That's an interesting point about maybe deeper water. Maybe they're congregating a little more. I've said it multiple times with Scott. When I caught my best trout, they're not in a school, but they're kind of like in the same subdivision.
Right.
You know?
They're hanging out.
Y'all found all those dead trout after the freeze, you found them in groups.
Yeah, they were
that's
together.
That's right. That's right.
That's what I'm saying. The past several years, they've been further off the shoreline.
But it's not a school. Just kind of in, like I said, subdivision. They're like around, across the street from each other. They're not running together necessarily, but they're kind of loosely together.
I guess you could say that. Yeah. There's been many times where a lot of big fish were caught in the same area very quickly.
Right.
No doubt about that. And I look for that to continue. But at the end of the day, it's all speculation right now. I'm real curious to see what's going to happen this fall as far as the birds working and what, you know, you and I did together last year. I'm real curious to see what it's like big fishing. Maybe there's going to be more people that don't think they're out there and they're going to be less pressured. I don't think anybody really knows. I'll pass that on.
What are you hearing, Scott, as far as like, you know, and what you would, I should say not hearing, but predict for big trout down in your area?
Man, I really don't know what to think.
Yeah.
I'm still hearing real spotty reports, you know, back in the bays. There for a while, it was just in the passes or just on the beachfront. Some have, you know, been doing better further back in the bays. So, I mean, like Caitlin said, we definitely lost a lot of fish.
Oh, I know.
I mean, Parks and Wildlife says my area and his area lost 40% of our fish. So just by that, there's fewer out there. There's fewer opportunities. But then you've got, you know, Shane and them putting fish back.
You know, oh, let's hit that in a second when we're through before I
really
forget.
Good thing there.
Yeah.
So, man, it's going to be interesting. You know, I do want to sit back and watch that. You know, I don't do the big trout thing all that much anymore.
Yeah.
But I do keep my ear to the ground and listen to what those guys are doing. And sometimes I'll kind of want to slip out there and do it myself.
I love it. You know it. Yeah. I was devastated by the seeing all those big trout, you know, after the freeze. But I'm also kind of not encouraged because we're all going to catch and release, hopefully. You know, but it's encouraging to see a 26, a 28, and air quote 30 that I saw at one point.
I was wondering if that was you or the original poster that put alleged 30.
Yeah, an alleged 30.
All due respect. I mean, it could have been just a bad picture, but big trout nevertheless. That's nice to know. And I'm intrigued by you've redeemed yourself, Caleb, because you're kind of like, shh, shh, and then you gave us some really good information there.
No, I couldn't care less about spots. I'm just saying, if a boat full of people that knows what they're doing drove off, and you just jumped in your boat and drove there and put the power poles down, it'd be an awkward situation.
Okay,
I'm trying to help me help you.
Okay. So I'll be interested to see that, and that's how we would. That's how I'm going to do it. That's how we would. Big trout hunt. Before we get out of here, so glad you mentioned Shane, because you had a nice interaction with him, Scott. Did he ever tell you, all I heard was thousands, if not tens of thousands or more trout were released?
5 million.
5 million?
Yeah. I want to say that's their goal.
That's ultimately their goal. But
for this year, it's 5 million trout.
And you know what? I was kind of reading your exchange with him. And I think he said ultimately, you asked the question, and he said ultimately, well, they expect like 17% survival rate. Dude, that's not bad.
Yeah, I want to know.
That's not bad at all for me.
Because trout, when they release them, are a lot smaller than the redfish when they release them.
Right. Because other predators and other trout.
Right. Everything eats everything out there.
Yeah.
And so are we just dumping a bunch of bait fishing and feeding the other fish when we do this?
Yeah.
So that's why I asked, you know, so what do we know on survival rates, you know, year one, two, three, or one, three, five, or you know, all that? And he said that through DNA sampling, which they keep track of the DNA involved with the trout from and the fish from the hatcheries, that through sampling in their gill net surveys and things along those lines, same samplings, whatever, boat ramp samplings, 17%.
Oh, 5 million? I'll take that.
Yeah, 17% of the fish that are sampled are hatchery fish.
Oh, yeah, I had that backwards.
So it doesn't mean necessarily 17%
of that.
It
could be even more.
That 5 million. It could be a whole lot bigger because nature's putting a lot more of them out there than we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hundreds of times more, thousands of times more are being naturally born out there, but
yet 17% of the survival is coming from those.
That you're seeing is from the ones that were released.
Which is, you start looking at the math on that, it almost doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do those fish, hatchery fish, having been raised and released as fingerling, does that give them a big leg up?
They might have an advantage.
Is it a big leg up on natural born fish?
All I was, like I said, all I'm saying is I was really encouraged because they go to about, as I remember the science, I've read this multiple times, to about 11 inches in the first year. Trout grow to about 11, 12 inches in the first year, year and a half.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
And then in the first 2 years, they can be keeper size, 16, 17. I think 16 is the number.
They want them to be able to spawn at least once before they're caught.
Yeah, so I think that's about a year and a half, 2 years. They'll get to 2 years, they'll get to 16 inches. Dude, I'll take that all day. I'll take that all day. That's a good, that's a really good thing that they're doing.
The other part that struck me on that, as I was, driving along coming mm-hmm. here and thinking about that little conversation was, okay, think if we didn't have the hatcheries.
Oh, I'd be killed. I'd be dead.
I mean, we'd be 17% fewer fish.
Yeah.
Overall.
On top of everything else.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a significant number.
Captain Caleb TV, what are you going to end up doing, man? What are you going to be doing this weekend, this week on your show?
Man, this week, I was actually, were you talking about Shane Bonnet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I talked to Shane about 2 or 3 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and he and I were looking to do some stuff together, and Scott's got me pumped up. I may see what his schedule looks like.
Let us know when you catch up with him. We'll get him in here.
Hey, when he and I talked, we talked about coming onto the show. I think
let's do it.
I think he's pretty well spoken. But yeah, no, we're gonna talk fishing and more instructional stuff. No telling. To be dead honest with you, I wake up Wednesday morning. I lay and stare at the ceiling about an hour, and then I go to the studio. I record it
and
up.
Figure
I send
it out.
I send it out, and I don't know. I'm getting close to 100 episodes now, I think. And so far, just about everything I've put out, people have liked. I'm waiting for the stinker. I've got to do it at some point.
No, don't say that.
One of the things my dad said when he was alive is they can't all be hit, son. So at some point. But no, we're basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to find something that's going on with the weather, something that's going on out there, and try to push forward something that could help you out this week.
All of y'all, please, please subscribe to him. And then even if you don't watch it, just turn it on in the background so he thinks he's getting more views.
Hey, that's fine. It'll work.
Because when he has one of those that bombs, guess who gets called?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, oh, man, I'm awful. I'm the worst person ever.
Hey, I have friends. I have friends. I will call them and be like, hey, turn it on. I don't care if you're cooking. Let the commercials play. I need to make my 12 cents on this. All right?
Well, and it's not even that. It's just when you have one that bombs, it bugs you so much.
Well, oh, yeah.
Yeah, you want to know.
The phone calls start.
You want to know something funny about it? We'll keep this quick, but Scott.
No, it's fine.
Scott, you'll agree with me that we've always talked about our best tips come from our worst days of fishing.
Yeah.
Okay. My videos that perform the best are the ones that I think suck.
And well, that should tell you something.
And then the ones that I'm like, man, this one's awesome. Yeah. And the analytics aren't where I want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of hurts my feelings a little bit. I mean.
Well, let's get Shane on here. Both y'all come in. We'll kill two birds at some point because that'd be good. And I know we were real rudimentary in our discussion and explanation. Me more than Scott, but still. And I'm getting my new Freedom Warrior probably in about 3 weeks. It'll be good to go. So shout out to Chet and the guys over at Freedom Boats USA in Port Lavaca. The boatyard, you can get it there. A couple of other places, just go to Freedom Boats. USA.com to find out some new dealerships. That's what I wanted to mention. He's got some new dealerships. That boat is really taking off. I mean, really, really, really taking off and doing a great job. So you guys, man, we really appreciate it. We have so much fun doing it. It's my favorite hour of the week every week, and it's all because of you. Keep the questions coming. We still got some in our back pocket for next week, so we'll get to those. Until then, tight lines, have fun, and go catch them up.